So I remember many years ago telling this story about Lazarus to my then very young daughter. And the amazement upon her face as she heard about Jesus going to the tomb and calling his friend out from the grave. And she looked at me so excited and she said, "You mean he's still alive?" And the disappointment was palpable as I had to explain to her, "Well, no, I mean, this was a long time ago. He still died." That dissonance of somebody who was brought back to life but still dying was pretty hard for a preschooler to grasp. And I think in a lot of ways, there's a lot in this story that is still hard for a lot of us to grasp. I mean, it's a story with a lot of contrasts, even conflicts, discord, and yes, dissonance. And as you heard, our theme for this whole season of Lent is dwelling in dissonance. And over the next 6 weeks, we're going to be following Jesus through the final days of his life, as reported in the Gospel of John. At this very time when Jesus' popularity and influence is reaching its peak, he's also finding himself in life-threatening conflict with the powers that be. And those who have spent the most time with him over the past few years, those who know him the best, are often confused as Jesus does not act in the ways that they expect him to. And that tension, that dissonance that they experience is what we are invited to live into in these 40 days of Lent. And so we begin this morning with a report that a certain man, Lazarus, was ill. Now, this is news that Jesus receives when he's across the river Jordan now, and he's told, "The one whom you love is ill." And surprisingly, he doesn't immediately head to be with his sick friend. As we've heard already, it's 2 days later when he finally tells his disciples that they should return to Judea, knowing that by now Lazarus, in fact, is dead. Now, the disciples are not eager to make this trip, and that shouldn't be a surprise, because the last time they were in that area, Jesus had very nearly been stoned for blasphemy. He narrowly escaped being arrested. And so when he announces his intention to go to Bethany, his disciples try to dissuade him, and they say, "Rabbi, the Jewish opposition wants to stone you, but you want to go back?" Now, a little bit of a side note here. I appreciate that the Common English Bible that we heard Cynthia read uses that phrase, "Jewish opposition." Most often, this text is translated as simply, the Jews want to stone you. And technically, that's what it says originally in the Gospel of John. It's the Jews. But given the conflict between Christianity and Judaism over the years, given the rising anti-Semitism that's all around us, I think we need to be very careful in painting such broad strokes. Careful about how we talk about those who are opposed to Jesus. I mean, Jesus himself, of course, is Jewish. All of his disciples are Jewish. And in fact, as we read through the story, we find repeatedly the Jews also being spoken of in very sympathetic ways. They comfort Martha and Mary. They mourn the loss of Lazarus. They are amazed when Jesus calls him from the tomb. And so we need to remember that it is a very specific faction of Jewish authorities who are seeking to get rid of Jesus, just as we need to remember that today it is a very specific ruling party in Israel that is committing genocide in Gaza, and not just broadly paint the Jews as those responsible. So, When Jesus persists now in his intention to travel to Judea, in spite of the threat from his enemies, Thomas speaks up. Thomas, who is unfairly remembered only for a single episode of doubt, in this instant, he courageously speaks up, saying, "Let us go to so that we may die with Jesus." His insightful words remind us of exactly where this whole story is heading. Jesus is going to die. He can't hide out in the wilderness forever as he has been. And so he goes to Bethany to be with his friends, Martha and Mary, in their grief. For John tells us Jesus loved Martha, her sister, and Lazarus. And so on his arrival, Martha greets Jesus with this mix of despair and perhaps anger as she says to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died." And those are words repeated pretty much verbatim by her sister later on in this chapter. And these words are an accusation that Jesus did not do what he could have, and also a plea, I think, to help them understand this tragedy. And if he truly loves them, why did he wait so long to come? And it's in that conversation with Martha that Jesus makes this truly remarkable statement where he says, "I am the resurrection and the life." Now notice he doesn't say, "I will be the resurrection someday." He doesn't say, "I know all about the resurrection." He says, "I am the resurrection," because he's not talking something about something just in the distant future. He's not talking about a theoretical construct, a vague possibility. He's talking about a very concrete reality of a dead man coming back to life. And after proclaiming that he is the resurrection and the life, Jesus asks Martha a very difficult question. "Do you believe this?" Now, that's a horrible thing to ask her. I mean, here's this woman whose brother has just died. In addition to the obvious loss that any of us experience when a loved one's passed, we need to remember that in this context, women rely very much on men for support financially. And Mary and Martha, who seem to be unmarried, would have been reliant upon their brother Lazarus economically as well as emotionally. And it's in the midst of this grief that Jesus has the gall to ask, "Do you believe that I am the resurrection and the life?" And to her credit, Martha says, "Yes, Lord, I believe." Now, there's some similarities here in that, like Thomas, we often remember Martha for one single incident where she's the one who's like too busy to really focus on Jesus. But here she makes a bold confession of faith. "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, God's Son, the one coming into the world." This is the most explicit statement of Jesus' identity that you're going to find anywhere in the Gospel of John. Before Jesus himself enters the tomb and rises on the third day, she declares him to be the Son of God. While her own brother is still in the grave, she proclaims him to be the Christ, the Messiah. In the midst of all the grief and the suffering and the death around her, she asserts unequivocally, "Yes, he is the resurrection and the life." And so, as if to affirm this bold statement, Jesus takes action. He goes down to the tomb, where Lazarus' body has been rotting now for 4 days. He calls his friend to come out. He calls Lazarus out of the tomb and back into the world. He calls him from death to life, from extinction to resurrection. And so death and grief and suffering do not have the last word. Recognizing that this is true, however, that Jesus in fact is the resurrection and the life, doesn't mean that we just sit around and wait for God to act and bring everything about. It doesn't mean that we expect God to wave a magic wand, wave this wand and make all the hardship and tragedy go away. It doesn't mean that we will not experience grief and suffering. In fact, it means quite the opposite. For the hard reality is that there is no resurrection without death. Despite Jesus' great love for them, he doesn't just jump in and rescue Mary and Martha from their grief. He doesn't waltz into Bethany and tell everybody, well, it's going to be okay, and he just magically pulls his friend out of the tomb. He begins by waiting, by leaving his friends to come to terms with the hard reality of the death of Lazarus. And when he ultimately arrives on the scene, he spends time first interacting with those loved ones, engaging with them emotionally, feeling their pain. And it's this passage then that gives us the shortest verse in the entire Bible, a verse that is brief yet deeply profound. Jesus began to cry. Or, as many translations put it even more succinctly, Jesus wept. One commentator notes, the God whom Christians worship is not a remote and aloof sky god out there somewhere. No, he's a tender God who is deeply moved, even grieved by anything and everything that threatens our human well-being. Indeed, ours is a God who does not just jump in and fix things for us. Ours is a God who lovingly suffers along with us, who walks with us in our grief, in our pain. Jesus never asks Martha or Mary to deny their brother's death. He doesn't try to console them by telling that Lazarus is in a better place or that God has a plan in all of this. He simply asks Martha to recognize that even in the midst of this death, there exists the possibility and the promise of resurrection. And it's that promise, that possibility that we continue to cling to today. For despite Jesus' ultimate victory, death clearly still persists. We read about it in the headlines of ongoing wars in Gaza, Ukraine, other places. We hear it in the stories of actions by ICE, the school shootings. We experience it personally in the loss of loved ones. In spite of Jesus' resurrection, dying remains an inescapable part of life. As my daughter came to understand many years ago, Lazarus himself still ultimately would die. I mean, Jesus doesn't just whisk him away to a place free of pain and suffering, where there are no sorrows, no troubles. Jesus doesn't intervene to make sure that nothing bad's going to happen to him again. Jesus brings him back to the same place where he'd previously lived, the same place that he'd gotten ill and had died, the same place where he faces all the difficulties, the trials, whatever it was he was dealing with before. And what's more, now Lazarus has to live with that added stigma of being the one whom Jesus has raised from the dead. John goes on in the following verses to talk about how this newfound notoriety makes him a target of the very same people who are trying to get rid of Jesus. If we read on in the next chapter, we are told that the chief priests decided that they would kill Lazarus too. It was because of Lazarus that many of the Jews had deserted them and come to believe in Jesus. So by raising Lazarus from his dead, Jesus actually exposes him potentially to more difficulties than he would have faced if Jesus had just shown up on time and healed him like he had done so many other people. Furthermore, the death and resurrection of Lazarus foreshadow what is about to happen to Jesus himself. In John's version of the gospel, this event is what's the last straw for the religious authorities. The verses immediately following our text point out that Jesus' ability to come in here and right under the noses of those authorities perform this incredible miracle and then leave again without interacting with them at all makes them even more determined to put an end to his ministry. Ultimately and ironically, it is the resurrection of Lazarus that leads directly to the death of Jesus. The truth is that life and death are far more intimately intertwined than we're usually willing to admit. I mean, even Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He then says, whoever believes in me will live even though they die. Not that they will live instead of dying, but they will live even though they die. He doesn't promise to remove suffering and death. Instead, God brings about something even greater through Jesus' own experience of death and destruction. For ultimately, life and death are not truly opposites. Neither fully exists without the other. For one who has not lived cannot die. and all who are alive must eventually succumb to death. And that's the tension, the dissonance that we live in every day. We live in the dissonance of life and death, of love and grief. And as much as we'd like to resolve that dissonance, we are invited, especially in this Lenten season, to dwell in that dissonance. I've had my own share of dwelling in that sort of dissonance in the past year. 11 months ago yesterday, my mother passed away unexpectedly after a very brief illness that nobody expected to end in her passing. Less than 6 weeks ago, that same daughter who was disappointed as a preschooler about Lazarus' death faced a much greater disappointment when the baby she was carrying died in utero. Now, in both of these losses, I have been buoyed by the love, by the support of many people, include a lot of you here. I've gotten emails and notes and words of encouragement, thoughtful gifts, and I'm comforted by your words, by your prayers, and I take solace in so much in these losses. I know that my mom was ready, that she passed away peacefully in her sleep, that it was a good death in so many ways. I'm incredibly grateful that my daughter and son-in-law are surrounded by a strong community of friends and church family where they live, that she received the medical care that she needed, that there's every reason to think that they'll still be able to have children in the future if they choose to do so. And still that loss is real. I experience the grief. I'll think of a question that I'd like to ask my mom that I'll never get a chance to hear her answer. I'm disappointed that I'm not going to be spending much of my upcoming sabbatical taking care of a newborn granddaughter as we expected to. And that's the dissonance. Love? Absolutely. But also grief. They live very close to one another. And I know, as I look around, many of you have experienced loss here. Many, far greater than what I've experienced. Loss of a spouse, death of a child. The grief of not having the dream that you wanted of having a child or a spouse. There are a lot of losses that many of us experience as we age. Absence of identity when a career comes to an end. Decline in physical and mental abilities. No matter what the loss is that you're grieving, I pray that you also have experienced the love of God and the love of your community. I also know that no matter how much of that love you've experienced, you still hold that grief. And Jesus invites us to accept that tension, to dwell in that dissonance. For though Lazarus died many years ago, his experience of life winning out over death, of love shining through in the midst of grief, that still stands as a source of hope and of encouragement for all of us today. For Jesus still declares, as he did long ago in Bethany, I am the resurrection and the life, and whoever believes in me will live, even though they die.